Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have an extraordinarily insightful program for you today. We're continuing with our conversations with remarkable minds. Dmitry Orlov, one of the world's leading thinkers, will be on. And we're going to talk about the pending social and economic disintegration ahead, but what you can do to lessen or survive it. We're going to look at the apocalyptic meltdown. The nightmare is underway. We're going to also look at the International Monetary Fund proposing a global wealth confiscation. That's right. They want to take money out of your savings account to pay for their debts. And if you think we're not in a bubble in the stock market, we'll discuss that. We're going to look at Can Evil Be Defeated by Professor Paul Craig Roberts. All that in our discussion with Dmitry Orlov. But before then, we always go to the latest in health and healing, and I've got a lot to share with you on that as well. Always positive, always meant to improve or save lives. I also have gotten a lot of feedback of people who are listening over the telephone. Take your phone wherever you're at. You can't get to a land-based station to listen, though we are heard in stations all across America. Or maybe your computer. Well, you can always get your cell phone or your regular telephone. Here's the number to call to listen to this program live. 712-432-7231. 712-432-7231. And also, we'd like to thank our sister station, WBAI in New York City, because just yesterday, we broke a record for the most people who've ever tuned in over that station or any of the Pacifica stations to listen over the Internet. And so that set a new record, and we're very happy about that. Let's begin, because we have a lot to deal with today. First up, we're going to take a look at that can light therapy help the brain? Now, this was a very interesting study from the VA Boston Health System, and they found that for people suffering from Gulf War Syndrome, light therapy does make a difference. And by the way, they use a helmet with light-emitting diodes and that apply red and near-infrared light to the scalp. And they've also done these diodes placed in their nostrils to deliver photons into the deeper parts of the brain. The light is painless and generates no heat, and the treatment takes about 30 minutes. Well, the therapy is very important because it's showing promise. Now, I'm writing a major article for those suffering from Gulf War Syndrome, and this will be one of the therapies that I'm going to suggest that people use. That's important. So light therapy for Gulf War Syndrome, post-traumatic stress disorder, yes. By the way, from the University of Liverpool in the United Kingdom, what is the number one cause of death worldwide? It's heart disease and stroke. Now, why? Well, there's really two answers according to this latest study. They're not really going into much of a depth on it. They're just saying that 12.3 million people died in 1 year of heart disease, and now it's gone up to 17.3 million in a relatively short period of time. What could be causing a huge increase in the number of people dying every year around the world from heart disease? And the answer is simple. People are getting older. It's that simple. It's also true here in the United States. This was published, by the way, in the New England Journal of Medicine. So what does it mean? Let's try to get a context and perspective on this. Context. Most people do not want to change. I'm sure many of you listening right now have a knowledge and skills that could help those that you love live longer and healthier lives. It doesn't mean that they embrace them. In fact, the closer you are to a member of your family trying to encourage them, the more likely they are to say, You live your life, I'll live mine. I've had that happen. I'm sure you have. But we all want change. Now, there's the contradiction. We just don't want to be the change we want. Most people. But the good news is about 5% of the American population are actively engaged in making healthy choices, committed to changing themselves and their circumstances. You say, well, that's 5%, big deal. 95% don't want to make change themselves, though they want the benefit of it. Okay, you're right again. Except there's 17 million people in that 5%. 17 million people is a very powerful force because an empowered minority always can influence a disempowered majority. So here's how you prevent heart disease. First and foremost, we know that there are certain risk factors. Alcohol, get rid of it. Processed sugars, animal fats, animal proteins, fried foods. And there's a whole lot of science behind each one of these. I'm just giving you the broad categorizations. Also, nutrient deficiencies like vitamin D will cause this, as will vitamin C, folic acid, B6, and B12. You end up with homocysteine elevated, and that can cause a big increase in heart attack and stroke. Also, too much salt in the diet, that can lead to hypertension. And having fats in the diet from any source that are saturated, except for coconut oil, can thicken the blood, and that makes you more susceptible to clots. A sedentary lifestyle. You're just not up and moving. Our body was meant to move, not sit in front of a computer or television. And we literally have studies showing the impact it has on your circulation and your heart and stress relationship. So you get rid of the negative. That's 50%. Now you include the positive. Lots of healthy water every day. We are dehydrated of good water. And don't say coffee. Oh, I drink 5 cups of coffee, you say. Well, that actually dehydrates you because the caffeine in it, the coffee, ends up causing dehydration, and hence electrolytes and minerals are lost from the body that you need. That's not good. Alcohol also dehydrates. You want clean, healthy water throughout the day. Juices are one of the best ways in the world to getting that. Organic produce, that's good. Green vegetables are good. Vitamin K, the best nutrients for your heart to keep it healthy, coenzyme Q10, NADH, vitamin E from mixed tocopherols, tocotrienols, L-carnitine, the herb hawthorn, and L-carnosine, vitamin C and quercetin, the omega fatty acids, whether from flax and hemp or from fish, all beneficial. That's how you have a healthy heart, plus exercising about 45 minutes a day and de-stressing. So then you won't be in one of those statistics. Also, a higher dietary vitamin C intake suppresses age-related thymic atrophy. Now, this is from the Institute of Gerontology in Japan, a major institute, highly respected. Quote, vitamin C is an essential nutrient for human and certain other animals. It has antioxidant properties and has been reported to ameliorate oxidative damage in lipids, DNA, and proteins. That's the study. So in this new research they did at the Institute of Gerontology, they talked about the immune function and how it's poorly understood, and especially the influence of the long-term high-dose vitamin C intake on a number and function of immune cells. Now, in the present study, they evaluated the immune effects of vitamin C when it's there and not there on the thymus gland, and which is crucial for your immune system. And they found it was very beneficial. So, quote, from the study, these results, meaning using high-dose vitamin C, suggest a long-term high-dose intake of vitamin C is effective in maintaining the immune system, partly through the suppression of age-related thymic involution in VC-deficient SPM4, or SPM30KO in the lab. So, vitamin C every day, high doses, helping your immune system. Now, I just mentioned carnitine, CARN, C-A-R-N, itine, I-T-I-N-E. It's a nutrient. It's one of the nutrients for the heart. In effect, it gives the heart energy. And that's important. Like a hawthorn helps vasodilate, so you get an opening of the arteries and the veins, allowing more blood to flow and also enhancing microcirculation to the brain, which helps prevent a stroke. By the way, taking a cayenne pepper capsule each day also helps prevent strokes, and you should always take one before you go to bed. And magnesium is also the most important mineral for your heart. About 1,000 milligrams of magnesium citrate will help prevent a heart attack. So you want to take those twice a day, in the morning and then before you go to bed. Now, this is from Clinical and Experimental Medicine. And what it says here is, according to this reporting of originating in Prague, Czechoslovakia, they said, quote, the aim of this study was to estimate the effect of carnitine supplementation on lipid, that's your fat disorders, like elevated cholesterol, that's a lipid disorder, and peripheral tissue insulin sensitivity, there's your diabetes. And so they did this study and found out that carnitine made a big difference. It was very important. So if you want to help your body, help your heart, help yourself if you have diabetes, then you want to take, I would say, 500 to 1,000 milligrams of carnitine a day. Now, another thing you can take to help your body, this is from Rutgers University, published Molecular and Cellular Oncology, is olive oil. Why? Because of what are called phenolic, phen, P-H-E-N, olic, O-L-I-C. These are compounds. These are known for helping the body, but one of them is particular. It is called oleocanthal. Oleo, O-L-E-O, canthal, C-A-N-T-H-A-L. Oleocanthal can selectively kill cancerous cells but leave all the other healthy cells alone. So that could help as an anti-cancer property, and that's probably why people in the Mediterranean who have olive oil and olives every day would make an enormous difference. So this was a good study, and it showed just one powerful nutrient in your olive oil, and always get your extra virgin organic olive oil. Don't buy the cheap brands. Don't buy light-colored brands. More likely than not, those are going to be soy oil or peanut oil disguised as olive oil. It's a huge racket out of Italy and Spain right now. And this was published in the journal Molecular and Cellular Oncology. Also, I was told by a woman who had a son who had advanced autism and was really very, very gone, not able to control the repetitive actions and movements, not able to speak, just grunt, and couldn't give him any more antipsychotic medication. He was on 4, but he was still having seizures, and she was listening to my program one day, and I was suggesting a protocol for seizures. And she tried it, and it worked. And from that, she not only stopped the seizures, went ahead and got a full protocol, and her son is alive and well today with no autism. And by the way, if you think that's just anecdotal, it is not. It didn't happen overnight. It took a long time. And you can't stop. You have to continue it every day. I invited that mother and father and young man to meet a group of 7,000 scientists in Washington, D.C. This was 5 years ago, when I was giving a presentation from one of my scientific papers that had been accepted as a feature to speak and share the information. And just so you know, they take all these, however many studies are presented, they have committees that select which ones are germane to the issue. And then once you're selected, you might be one of 7 in a given day for 2 or 3 days. And people come from all over the world, and they want to know what's going on. And it's a way of sharing information. But these are circulated. So everyone has a chance to see your work before you present it, and then up on a stage, there's a big screen behind you, and your article is presented, and then you can have talking points, and you can go to graphs and charts and show what you're doing. And that's how it works. And in fact, I have one coming up on a new study. In any case, instead of doing my study, I invited this family up on stage to talk about the reversal of autism. And then afterwards, hundreds and hundreds of the scientists and physicians from around the world went out into the hallway and met with the family and talked with them. So, because they'd never seen anyone. And to my knowledge, there are no people who've completely reversed it, who had advanced autism, who are alive today. But any physician, nurse, anyone engaged in public health who would like information on this, it's all up on my website. The articles are published. The protocols are there. Happy to help people. So this is from the University of Chicago. And there was generally what is called a temporal lobe epilepsy. That comes when people might have brain surgery. And the surgery might help them, but it never controls the seizures. So what stopped the seizures? Well, in this particular study, it was coconut oil. Now, mind you, this person was doing yoga and meditation and dietary changes, and that was fine. Didn't stop the seizures. But 2 tablespoons of coconut oil a day in a smoothie did. This person was seizure-free in 9 weeks. And that's the longest this person had ever gone without having seizures. So that's one person. But that's one person is all it takes to let people say, let me try that. Because coconut oil is extraordinarily healing. It's just one of nature's most promising new foods, superfoods. And finally, ultrasound shows promise in this laboratory study for treating Alzheimer's. This was from the University of Queensland in Australia. Quote, ultrasound treatment helped remove brain plaques and improve memory in mice genetically engineered to develop symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. And this is an early stage result. So that's something that is interesting. And because I want to present all information that I read in the scientific literature on Alzheimer's, I was saying this is worth looking at. So I'll keep you posted. It's early. There's lots going on, and it takes time to evolve. But as it does evolve, I'll share it with you. Whole lot more on our next program. We're going to take a break and come back with our guest. I want to give him a lot of time because we have a lot of things to share. Dmitry Orlov in a moment. Please stay with us.
On the oceans and upon high seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, mercy, mercy me. Things ain't what they used to be. Radiation underground and in the sky.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll. My guest from Panama, or near there, on a boat, is Dmitry Orlov. Dmitry and I will be talking about the pending social and economic disintegration ahead, not to scare people, not to have anyone panic, but rather to give them an honest, objective look at what is likely to come, but what we can also do if we choose not to be indifferent to it, and so we're not affected in the same way as others would be by it. Dmitry is a Russian-American engineer, an author. He has a background in economics, environmental, political issues. He specifically researches and writes about the decline and collapse of the U.S. and modern industrial culture. He was an eyewitness to the collapse of the Soviet Union, and he's researched extensively its causes and the reasons for the failure of both the Soviets and the Americans to predict and understand it accurately. He is also very popular among the peak oil communities, such as the Richard Heinberg Group, and frequently writes on the looming energy crisis. Nice to have you with us today, Dmitry.
Great to be on your show, Gary.
Thank you. Dmitry, and by the way, Dmitry also has written five books, notably The Five Stages of Collapse, Survival's Toolkit. More recently, he's written a collection of essays under the title Societies That Collapse and Communities That Abide. And so we'll go to that later. During our last conversation, Dmitry, we touched upon the pending economic and infrastructural and social disintegration that the U.S. is facing, which includes the impact of climate change and global warming. So I invited you back to focus on this and then speak about possible solutions or ways we can survive through these crises. Now, right now, the larger overview is this. We are hearing more and more of a likely financial collapse across all markets. The derivative bubble is now at $600 trillion worldwide, far larger than it was in 2008 before the meltdown. There is a political bubble in Washington that is in complete denial of the looming problems and is making matters worse by relying upon the same old solutions from the same people and institutes and think tanks, the same corporate Democrat and liberal groups and individuals. Now, we are also witnessing very clear signs, such as the militarization of law enforcement, draconian laws that strengthen efforts of U.S. intelligence to track citizens, no abatement to lessen our reliance upon fossil fuels, and more people who could work who are unemployed, 100 million now, and yet we're lying to people saying, oh, look at unemployment's great, and it's not great. People just can't find jobs and have stopped looking for jobs. There is also the rapidly growing distrust of the two political parties in power, as well as distrust of corporations and the banking system. So I'd like for you to lay out for us, or choreograph, as it were, the areas of collapse and disintegration that we're likely to see in the near term. I mean, within the next year, 2 years, 3 years at the outside. And as we begin what I perceive to be a system-wide implosion. And then I also believe that not only will we see this implosion in countries like Spain, Italy, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, but then, and I'm not even talking about the Middle East now, what's going on there, but I'm also seeing, because these do not involve terrorists, these involve the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and others in the European Central Bank and financial managers putting so much pressure for these countries to give them, the bankers, money by taking it out of pensions and salaries, cutting back everything that represents a quality of life for the citizens living there, as if these citizens are not going to do anything. I believe that we are right at the cusp of a major pushback that will not just stop at people protesting the cuts in their pensions or their jobs, but something is going to get out of control. I'd like your thoughts on this, please.
Well, I've for a long time I've thought that the first stage of collapse is going to be financial, because that's the most fragile part of the entire framework. It is also susceptible to stampedes, to irrationality. Right now, the whole idea of that, you know, stocks will continue to go up because the Federal Reserve will not allow them to go down, is the sort of theatrical suspension of disbelief that prevails in the financial markets. Now, certain things happen when confidence fails, when you get back to basics and realize that basically debt taken out on the future will no longer be repayable if that future is economically smaller, with fewer people working, with less being made, with wealth being consumed rather than created because of the gigantic overhang of supposedly wealthy older people. All of those things basically, you know, they cause a panic, they cause the system to lock up, and then we are suddenly in a new world where the only thing that matters is who you know and what access to actual resources you have. How much of your own food do you grow? Do you know by name people who do grow their own food who might share it with you? Do you rely on pumped water, or do you collect rainwater? Do you have a water purification system, for instance? Do you rely on being able to go to a gas station and pay the money to get gasoline, or do you have some other way of getting around? All of those things are very, very essential to survival once money is basically out of the picture. Now, this is something that happens over and over, all over the place, over and over again. You know, the recent place where that happened is the Ukraine, where the hryvnia, the national currency, has become worthless. And people there do resort to various techniques that allow them to survive under those circumstances, because this isn't the first time. The problem is, in the developed world, people don't know what to do. They haven't practiced this at all.
Well, let's take this a little further then. I would like your scenario of what you see happening in the United States over the next 2 to 3 years as far as the concentration of wealth and hence privilege, meaning if you're able to afford to live in certain areas, you will have everything you would normally have, even more, food, clean water, restaurants, culture, schools, education, business opportunities, will all social and societal events will all still remain the same. But only if you are able to be in that zone, where outside of that zone, you will not have the same comforts or privilege, nor protections, nor ability to have a quality of life, because there will be chaos. There will literally be so little elements that normally we rely upon, like quality public transportation, lights, and we're going to end up ghettoizing the rest of America. And I think it's going to happen quickly. I think it'll happen where people will want to have it confronted. Those in comfort zones want to have their comfort, and they don't want anyone else infringing upon it. And it'll be an ugly scene. Now, I hope I am wrong, but I'd like for you to share with us what you see.
Well, Gary, the world that you just described is the world that we've been living in for at least a decade, if not more. I mean, the last time that the United States was actually a country that served the interest of the entire population, you have to go back to the 50s, I think. The country has become progressively de-democratized. So, you know, yes, at this point, there are these little rich enclaves of prosperity and stability and safety, and there are just huge parts of the country where, you know, there's nothing except slavery as a choice. Right now, the United States has the largest number of slaves that it has ever had in the form of the prison population, people who have no rights, who work for much less than minimum wage, and who have no other options except to commit a crime in order to feed their families and then go to jail for it. So what you described already exists. It's not something we look forward to. It's something that's here today. Now, what happens when money fails, when you show up with your stack of Ben Franklin's and somebody says with a foreign accent, "Your money is no good here, sir," what do you do after that? Well, it doesn't matter at that point whether you're rich or poor. If you're rich, then you're dependent on an army of servants to service your very every need. And so you're just completely helpless, because your servants will abandon you because they're more interested in food than money. Money doesn't buy food at that point. It's worthless. Now, if you're poor and you've practiced being poor for a long time, then you will just continue being poor, and your chances of surviving are much better. It's counterintuitive, but that's how it works.
Take us through this scenario of Professor Paul Craig Roberts from Strategic Cultural Foundation. Quote, "Can evil be defeated?" Again, this is Professor Paul Craig Roberts' statements. "We live in an electronic concentration camp. We are addicted to images on screens that disform, disinform, and propagandize us to accept and even welcome the police state activities that have destroyed our autonomy, privacy, and independence. The outlook for civil liberties grows bleaker by the day. From the government's embrace of indefinite detention of U.S. citizens and armed surveillance drones flying overhead to warrantless surveillance of phone, email, and internet communications and prosecutions of government whistleblowers. The homeland is ruled by a police industrial complex, an extension of the American military empire. Everything that our founding fathers warned against is now the new norm. The government has trained its sights on the American people. We have become the enemy. All the while, the American people remain largely oblivious. We are continually abused in the name of protecting us. Just ordinary Americans are subject to far worse abuse from government than they have been in the past. 4-year-old children are handcuffed by police. 95-year-old citizens with walkers are body slammed with their necks broken by police. War veterans with no legs and wheelchair bound are shot, murdered by police. The police are always justifying their abuse and criminal acts by claiming they felt threatened. What kind of heavily armed police, usually together in gangs, is threatened by a 4-year-old boy or a 94-year-old bedridden man? Or a double amputee. The fact the police get away with this brutality shows their total lack of humanity and the total transformation of the purpose of police. Today, a paranoid police protect not the public, but the police state themselves from the public. We pay them to abuse and murder us. Washington Post reported that state and local police have become bandits, as in Mexico, who stop drivers in order to rob them. Yes, they do this. In fact, they have taken thousands of people's money. They are now trained in courses in which police are trained in the art of highway robbery. They're used to create an industry that trains police in the aggressive techniques of highway interdiction. It is now routine for a traffic stop, whether justified or not, to result in the confiscation of your cash, all of your possessions, and even your car. You can be robbed by police on the basis of their assumptions without being ticketed or charged with a crime. The federal government alone seized $4.2 billion in assets last year, despite the fact that these were not from people that had committed a crime or were charged in 80% of the cases. Did you know that the school security industry is a $4.9 billion yearly business that instills in youth acceptance of tyranny and punishments for infractions that are simply the normal behavior of youth? Did you know that Halliburton received Dick Cheney's old firm $385 million to build concentration camps in the United States? Did you know that Republicans had privatized the prison system, turned into a $70 billion a year industry that demands ever more incarceration of citizens in order to give it profits? Consequently, 2.7 million American children now have at least one parent in prison. U.S. prison labor is now the cheapest form of labor available, with prisoners paid 93 cents per day. Prisoners make office furniture, work in call centers, fabricate body armor, take hotel reservations, work in slaughterhouses, manufacture textiles, shoes, and clothing, process agricultural products like milk and beef, package Starbucks coffee, shrink wrap software for Microsoft, sew lingerie for Victoria's Secret, produce military helmets, shirts, pants, tents, bags, canteens, and a variety of other equipment, including making circuit boards for IBM, Texas Instruments, and Dell. Sew McDonald uniforms and perform labor services for Boeing, Motorola, Comcast, and Revlon and Kmart. Even the mainstream media has reported that the U.S. military drills in South Florida were military teams working with local police practice rounding up American citizens for detention. It seems clear that these are federal troops practicing control of the population, which is being stripped of the constitutional right to hold government accountable. A pointless lockdown of Boston and its suburbs and the gratuitous hours of house-to-house searches, a martial law exercise clearly prepared for what means. It is now routine for police to amuse themselves by carrying out strip searches and vaginal searches of women. Police go out of their way to provoke resistance so they can beat, taser, and murder. If they can't provoke you, they beat you, taser you, and murder you anyway and claim their victim resisted arrest or threatened them. Have you noticed how the police find everyone threatening? Yes. Look at our educational system. Entertainment and television serve to indoctrinate and teach compliance. Television can do more harm than imaginable because it creates public opinion. It is used to alter the world view of the population. Our cars, household appliances, and smartphones are becoming devices designed to spy on us and report noncompliance. A society is being created in which there can be no autonomy, no freedom. The technology that permits the electronic concentration camp is produced by thoughtless people who have no concern for liberty. In conclusion, we believe that tens of millions of Americans, probably hundreds of millions of Americans, are unaware of how they're being manipulated. And when they push back, they'll be met with brutal force. Even police in small towns now have helicopters, armed personnel carriers, tanks, machine guns, rocket-propelled grenades, drones, night vision, heat sensors, sensors that can see through your walls of your houses and into your cars. If this is not enough, in comes the National Guard of Federal Troops, Army Rangers, Navy SEALs, or simply release the germs. Washington can deal with its citizens the same way it dealt with indigenous people that we called Indians. Washington has retained in its hands live smallpox, a deadly killer. How did it come to this? Americans are distracted by sex, entertainment, the difficulty of providing for themselves and families. They are locked into the disinformation that sustains the American matrix, blinded by their patriotism and their 4th of July speeches and by their indoctrination that Americans are exceptional and indispensable. And, of course, by their ignorance and arrogance, Americans simply have no clue. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, you know, what comes around goes around. What this country has been doing to other countries in the world is what it's going to be doing to itself. If you want to look at the future of the United States, look at Iraq today. It's as simple as that. You can't have a double standard. Do one thing to other people and another thing to your own. It just doesn't work that way. So, you know, basically Americans are going to get what they paid for. And the interesting thing to me is that there won't really be this us or them thing. So, for instance, the well-placed individuals who are currently feeling very well defended and secure can very easily find themselves on the other side of, a police force. Once that police force decides that the official sources of funding are insufficient and merge with some drug cartels. So that's something that can happen, does happen as a matter of course.
It's happened in Mexico, Colombia, Ecuador, Honduras.
It happens in every single place where, you know, there's a police force with absolutely overwhelming power, or in some countries, the military, and it decides that the official sources of revenue are insufficient. And when that happens, it's very difficult to figure out who's on the right side, who's on the wrong side, because at the very minimum, you decide who the opposition is, and you eliminate them. So, you know, for instance, if the police in the United States, they decide to side with the Republicans to make some kind of like an official political cover for themselves, then they might go ahead and exterminate all the Democrats. Things like that happen in the third world, and a lot of that has been supported and instigated to some extent by the United States. So why would anyone be surprised when it starts happening in the United States itself?
We have seen the ghettoization of America for a long time. We just don't want to acknowledge it. In Los Angeles, there are certain areas people who live in Beverly Hills or West Los Angeles will not drive to. This is also true in New York City. There are parts of Harlem or Bed-Stuy or other places in Brooklyn they won't drive to. They're afraid, as if these are people who are going to put them at risk. I believe that it's only a matter of time, and that time is becoming sooner, where we will have a breakdown of that system, and then we'll see a blowback. But before I get to that, I want to deal with the economy in a moment. This is just in. This is from Global Research, a very quality source. Quote, the International Monetary Fund proposes global wealth confiscation, the appropriation of household savings. Quote, as first reported by Forbes, the International Monetary Fund dropped a bomb in the October fiscal monitor report. The report paints a dire picture of high-debt nations that fail to aggressively, quote, mobilize domestic revenue, which is code for aggressively tax its citizens. It goes on to build a case for dramatic measures and recommends a series of escalating income and compensation and consumption tax increases. Why is the International Monetary Fund proposing this? Because global governments and central banks pumped trillions of dollars of your money into the banks and stock market over the last several years, catapulting public debt to tens of trillions of dollars. But now governments and central banks can no longer sustain these debt levels, and global wealth confiscation is the only way to maintain the Ponzi scheme. The wolves are starving for your money. Here is an excerpt from the International Monetary Fund clearly advocating a tax on your private savings to pay down government debt. Quote, this is from the International Monetary Fund. The sharp deterioration of the public finances in many countries has revised interest in a capital levy, a one-off tax on private wealth, as an exceptional measure to restore debt sustainability. The tax rates needed to bring down public debt to pre-crisis levels are sizable. Reducing debt ratios to end 2011 would require a 10% on households with positive net wealth, end quote. You heard me right. The International Monetary Fund wants to take 10% of your private savings in addition to the taxes you're already paying, and you'd have no say-so in it. But they want to confiscate it out of your bank accounts, and so you would have no choice, you would have no say-so, and that is a reality that they're looking at. Now, they've already done this. They did it last year in Cyprus. Your thoughts on this, Dimitri?
Well, I think 10% is a good deal because the other option is 100%. The other option is the entire financial system locks up, and the numbers that you supposedly have in some computer at a bank get zeroed out. So that's the other alternative. But I don't think the IMF really has a plan. You know, this is basically a model that they have, you know, that might work on paper. I don't think it'll work in reality because the major players, the ones that they really want to go after, you know, not the people with, you know, maybe $10,000 in the bank, but people with millions or billions, they own enough of the system to basically jump ship early. This is what happened in Cyprus. The little people, you know, they got a lot of their money confiscated, but the major investors, they got tipped off early. And the way it went there was, you know, basically there was a bank holiday on Cyprus. You couldn't get your money out if you were in Cyprus. However, if you could jump on a plane and fly to Heathrow Airport and take a taxi to downtown London, there was a branch of the Cyprus bank open in London in spite of the bank holiday, and people could go there and make their withdrawals in person. And they did that the day before all of these capital controls and confiscation kicked in. So this is what happens every time. If you try to try to impose the sort of wealth confiscation scheme, you end up with very small potatoes, and all the major people, the major money bags that make your little model inside your computer work become untenable.
Now let's take a look at the bubble. I believe that we are in the following bubbles, and every one of these will crash. A commercial real estate bubble, a bond bubble, an equity stock market bubble, a strength of the dollar bubble. Now, mind you, at this moment, the dollar is the strongest currency in the world, and the euro has fallen tremendously. It's almost on parity with the dollar. And because the Eurozone is in an economic mess, including in Germany, they have the highest unemployment poverty rate, 14% poverty rate in Germany, the highest since World War II. And yet they have great wealth, industrial wealth and banking wealth, but they also have a massive amount of poverty. So I see these bubbles as being critical. We have a student debt bubble, and we have a mortgage underwater bubble, where people are still staying in their homes, but they're underwater, so they're paying equity to the banks and the companies that own their mortgage, yet it will never come back. And we also see a re-stimulation of the real estate bubble, because we do not have young Americans coming out of college, about to form a family, and buying a home. That is the historical way that the 1 to 2% a year increase in the real estate market occurred. So we have those bubbles. Now, this is from Mike Snyder from Economic Collapse. Quote, if anyone doubts that we are in a stock market bubble, then they should read this article. Then in this article, he shows about, you know, we just hit 18,000. But what is the actual value based upon the real economy? And it's probably around 6,000 to 7,000. So the rest is a bubble. How did we get there? So take a look at this, plus the $600 trillion derivative dagger that is hanging over our heads, and discuss this, please.
Well, working from it backwards, the derivative bubble is basically deals made between financial players. And what happens when the derivative bubble pops is that these financial players end up owing each other fabulous sums of money. But the point is that these fabulous sums of money are owed between these entities to each other. So the way to deal with the derivatives bubble is to basically have them sit down in a room and net it all out and zero it all out. And maybe they'll walk away with a little bit of something, and maybe they will walk away with a big fat zero. It was a fun game while it was happening, but now it's over, so goodbye. So, you know, that's basically it. As far as all the other, you know, bubbles that have been, you know, created, again, it's a question of writing down debt and the question of unwillingness to write down that debt. And it happens in funny ways. For instance, if at the height of the 2007-8 real estate bubble, you stopped paying your mortgage and continued to live in your house, and instead of paying your mortgage, paid your lawyer a retainer to basically continue to get continuations of the case, et cetera, just drag it out. Lawyers are very good at dragging it out. Well, it turns out that, you know, if this has been dragged out for as long as possible until now, the statute of limitations on your foreclosure has expired, and you now basically own your property free and clear as a result of not paying your mortgage. So there are all sorts of perverse ways of getting rid of debt that also work. So none of those things are serious.
What if we advocated all students have a moratorium on all student debt? Don't pay a penny back. And if everyone did it, then we could get legislation to change the bankruptcy laws. Why not advocate a national strike of students and teachers?
Because I don't think it would help matters at all. Because if you look what's actually happening now, the number of student loans in repayment keeps going down. The number of student loans in deferment or basically that are, you know, bad loans, it keeps going up. And so this is going to be a trend whether we do anything or not. The whole point is that most of the student debt is unrepayable because the students didn't get their money's worth. In the final analysis, that those diplomas they got, they do not provide for a better income that would allow them to repay those loans. And that's the fundamental point of it. So you can do all sorts of advocacy, et cetera, but in the final analysis, all that matters is reality. But as far as the overall pattern of bubble, you see bubble formation. You see, if you have an economy that's addicted to debt and it suddenly stops growing, which is what happened around 2008, all of the growth that we've had is not real growth. It's basically debt-fueled growth in finance and various financial schemes. It's not the part of the economy that actually produces products that people can consume or services that people can avail themselves of in some life-sustaining way. It's all basically a paper game. So basically, when the economy stopped growing, the only thing that could be done to sustain it was to take on ever-increasing amounts of debt. It's sort of like a patient with Ebola who is hemorrhaging from every single orifice, needs bigger and bigger transfusions of plasma in order to keep the patient from going into shock from loss of body blood volume. And so this is what this debt bubble looks like. But at some point it stops working, and when it stops working, the first entities that will be affected will be all the financial entities. They will become insolvent and will be forced to stop functioning. After that, all of the entities that that depend on commercial loans and lines of credit and letters of credit in order to continue their operation, they will stop functioning. And then all of the retail outlets that receive product from those other entities, they will stop functioning. So it will be a cascaded failure.
Do you, Dimitri, I need a short answer on this. In the very near future, let's say the next 3 years, unless something radically changes, do you see social collapse in the United States?
I think social collapse in the United States has already pretty much run its course. People are very alienated from each other. They're very afraid. I've been living in Central America for the past half a year where everyone is friendly. Nobody's afraid of each other. Everybody talks. You can go play with anyone's kid and nobody thinks of anything about it. You know, it's like everyone's kids are everyone's kids. Try that in America and you will get arrested. America is a scary place socially. It's very far gone.
Last question. Right now, China has just created what amounts to its own major bank, equal to, not the same resources, but equal to the European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund and to the Federal Reserve in its influence. And already, England, France, Germany, Norway, South Korea, Japan's thinking about it, China and India, Brazil are all joining it. That means that they are going to be looking towards a gold as a substantial part of their backing of this, which America has zero to back up its except its reputation for the money it gives out. Also, they're moving towards a mixed currency. So it's only a matter of time. I figure 2 years before China becomes the number one economic power in the world, and then the mixed currency is going to be put into effect, and the dollar will no longer be the only reserve currency, and you'll see a collapse of the value of the dollar. Right now it's strong, but I believe the dollar is going to just go right down substantially, and therefore people who have mortgages or debts or have cash are going to be creamed. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, you have to think of China and Russia pretty much as a unit, political, military, economic unit, to some extent even social unit, because there's just so much interaction between people settling on different sides of this very transparent, borderline, non-existent border between the two countries. Now, if you join the two of them together, they have a huge population, they have a huge resource base, they have fantastic popularity around the world because they're the only two countries who can stand up to the United States, and the two of them combined are absolutely the most dominant power on Earth. It's not like they will become that, it's that they already are. And what we're looking at now is the financial rearrangement that's happening away from the U.S. dollar, away from the United States, and towards a more equitable system where countries around the world can buy into a scheme as a result of borrowing from it, which is not something that the IMF has ever wanted to make possible. If you borrow from the IMF, it's not like you become a shareholder or you get a seat at the table where you can negotiate an equitable arrangement for yourself. So everybody is going to be fleeing from the IMF and joining their and forming various other entities that allow them to borrow money for development in, on more equitable terms.
So do you see the collapse of the dollar?
Well, yes, right now it's basically all of this loose change from around the world, all these people who think that, you know, they'll be rich forever, and they're basically moving their wealth in, into the United States, into the safest safe haven investments they can find, such as U.S. Treasuries, and I've been saying that for a long time. The United States is where big money goes to die. And, you know, basically, yes, it's the last bubble. The dollar bubble is the last bubble. Once that pops, you can pretty much sweep up the ashes.
I appreciate your insights, Dimitri. The more that we hear, the more we realize we have to get off the grid. We have to become more self-sufficient. We have to use the millions of resources and start networking with people for the ability to learn skills, to have barter, exchange, to look at shared communities. That's the future, not living the way we've continued and expect anything good to come from it. All the best to you, Dimitri, and we look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Gary.
Dimitri Orlov, down in Panama, and I'm Gary Knoll. That brings us to the conclusion of this program, and thank you all for listening. And we'll be having a whole series of programs next week on what to do, how we can take charge. And knowing the truth of what's coming at us is the very first step. You can't change anything constructively if you're living in denial of what's been past and what is present. Have a nice day, everyone.